Sound Pages is a literary series featuring resident artists in the Jack Straw Writers Program.
This giant's land is sparse and miserly. At noon, he gazes deeply into it, as if he could see his children's faces under the frosted crust of the horizon.
This program features the work of 2015 writer Laura Day. She spoke with curator Kevin Kraft about her work.
I want to start by asking you about your current project, what you are working on as a Jack Straw Fellow.
I'm working on a project that I'd like to turn into a book-length manuscript, and it's exploring the surveying and mapping of the American West. So what I'm trying to do is write a sequence of poems that are more narrative in character, and they explore two different men's lives from birth to adulthood. And then I'm juxtaposing that with more lyrical poems that look at some of the images and consequences of Native American loss of land and forced movement and European American surveying, mapping, and colonialism of Western land.
These characters, the men that you described, can you tell us a little bit more about them? Are they historical figures, figures of your imagination?
I think they're mostly figures of imagination, but I think they have elements that are sort of historical composites. And I wanted to have characters to kind of latch the events to, because I think for me, when I was writing it, it helped me feel more attached to what was happening in history. And I thought as a reader, it would allow people kind of a doorway to see some of those events and images in a way that they could relate to.
Mm-hmm. Are they Native figures?
One is a Shawnee who moves from his traditional homeland through the forced period of Indian removal. And the other is a European American who grows up and becomes a surveyor.
I see. So somebody who's actually doing the surveying.
Propelling some of the movement westward.
Yeah. Do your characters feel actively complicit in the acts of surveying and dividing up the land, or are they just swept along by historical forces or some combination?
Well, one thing that I really want to do, and I think a clear perspective that I have, is I'd like to, particularly through the Native American character, allow more agency than is generally given to Native people. So I'm working hard to make sure it doesn't feel that he is simply swept up in the currents of history. And I want to allow him to have more of a perspective and more of a full person. And the same thing goes for the other character as well.
Hmm. What are some of the challenges you're finding in confronting this material and turning it into poetry? Some of the technical challenges in the writing, or even some of the personal challenges in facing these aspects of history?
A technical challenge is balancing lyrical and image-rich, wanting to write in that mode and having a narrative that doesn't become too didactic or fictional.
Mm-hmm.
That's been really an interesting puzzle, and I'm enjoying it, but finding it also quite challenging. And then a research challenge is, of course, that American history is so one-sided that to find the Native perspective requires a lot of digging and a lot of maybe inferential thinking, talking to members of my own community. It's illuminating to see how little is left of that account. So that's emotional as well.
I see. So according to your biography, you are affiliated with the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma. Right? But you've also lived in the Pacific Northwest for most of your life. Can you talk about the relationship between those two? I mean, did you move here at a young age, or do you go back to Oklahoma very often?
Sure. So I'm an enrolled tribal member, but my family left the tribal reservation a couple of generations ago, which is actually a pretty common Native American experience. So I've grown up pretty far away from my tribal community, but have maintained a strong relationship. So I do enjoy going back to Oklahoma. And also in this era, it's a lot easier to maintain contact with fellow tribal members.
What When did you first turn to poetry as a means of expression?
I think I was in my late teens. I really enjoyed reading poetry from maybe eighth grade or so on. And when I graduated from high school, I went to the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe. It's a really small tribal school, but they have an amazing writing program. And at the time, Arthur Zee, who's a poet, was teaching there, as was John Davis, and they're both really amazing poets. So I sort of found my way into that program and became very interested in poetry.
Had you gone there for other reasons, like visual arts or something like that?
Originally, I had actually intended to be a museum studies major.
I see. But the encounter with a good teacher was one of the pivotal points for you in your journey?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Just that kind of chance encounter with really amazing professors, I think, well, it helped me realize that it was something that I wanted to pursue.
Why don't we hear a poem?
Okay. I'd like to read a poem from my new manuscript. And this particular poem looks at the history of identifying frontiers. And it also looks at the ramifications of measuring land and the idea of the mathematical measurement of land having an impact on the human cost of loss of land. This poem is called Blazed Trunk. Devoid of new frontiers since the Romans mortared Hadrian's Wall, settlers' ancestors saw the axe's blazed union in the milkwood of the living tree as a horse's lean face. Nautilus spiral of township squares. Newly ratified treaties diminish the land with mathematical exactitude, each acre to be paid out in trust. As the rigs curve smaller and smaller in a Fibonacci sequence, the establishment of an office of surveyor general, possession following measurement, generally preceding statehood, numerated agony made linear, as with the bondage line of the 36th parallel.
Wow. There's a kind of almost clinical detachment in the way the diction of enumeration sort of compiles in that poem, and you can kind of feel, you know, the soul bursting at the constraints behind it. Tell me a little bit more about how you came to be interested in that particular angle of it. It's fascinating to me to think about borders and frontiers and mapping and measuring and all of that. And I mean, it's obviously a significant part of U.S. history. But how did you come to zero in on that particular aspect as a gateway into this larger story?
Well, I think it began for me when I started to do a lot of research about the Shawnee removal from areas in Ohio, which is a traditional homeland, during the period of Indian removal. And I thought about that a lot because I think it's been so catastrophic for the Shawnee people even today. I think that that particular removal was, it was such a blow to the Shawnee people that I wanted to look at how it happened. And I needed a lens to see how this was possible because it was such an act of horrible cruelty and theft. And I think that I came to the idea of surveying and measurement as a manageable way to look at how people justified some of the actions in history.
So your challenge is to then show this language that enabled these acts, but at the same time opening the reader up to the suffering and behind it. How would you say that that's comes forward in your work?
Well, one thing particularly with these movements between the more narrative pieces, I'd like people to feel some tension between that sort of objectivist litany, and I'd like people to question what was behind it.
Now we'll hear a selection from Laura's live reading.
The Points of Beginning. Geodesia, the art of surveying and measuring, footpath stamped and deer path trampled. Wily agents of creation, foliated under great pressure. White-banded rock embedded in absolute time's alluvial fan. The first creeping act of range is the infant's change of heart from open to closed upon the initial intake of breath, thence with the meanders of the river. Claws in the water. Born to the scattered Confederacy, 43 degrees, 34 minutes, 33 seconds north, 84 degrees, 11 minutes, 34 seconds west, Wapakoneta, white bones in the Shawnee tongue. Across the boards of the cabin, his mother cries for the sound of moving water. First birth pain so urgent, it longs for a current to fix itself too. Her younger sister pours water from one jug to another beside her ear and then into her mouth with sweating hands. Winter child, bound in the harvest's last floss of soft rabbit fur. His mama's milk is thin and reedy, almost lilac-colored and sparse as December's sun. An uncle holds him in the doorway of the cabin, sweeping aside the burst of snow with a free hand. At 4 months, the baby sucks corn porridge from the corner of a calico rag and teethes across a blanched knuckle of bone. 12th infant of that year, the Quakers baptize him Lazarus, but that is not the name he turns to. So those poems are from the very beginning of this manuscript. And next, I want to jump through time. And I'd like to read some poems from the end. Now, these poems are the poems that are included in the Jack Straw anthology. And the time frame for these poems is after 1830. In 1830, the Indian Removal Act was passed. And as a consequence, many tribes, in fact, almost every tribe from east of the Mississippi was forcibly removed from their homelands and into Indian territory, which at that time was parts of Missouri and most of Kansas and parts of Oklahoma, as we know them now. So the poems in this section explore the main character, Lazarus, and his life post-movement. Now, after that movement, if you track through history, it was really catastrophic on every level for every tribe that was impacted by it. The Shawnee tribe, and particularly my branch of the Shawnee tribe, the Eastern Shawnee, at the time that they lived in the Ohio area prior to this removal, there were about 1,000 Eastern Shawnee tribal members living in that community. And when they did the first sort of official census in Indian territory in around 1834, 4 years later, there were 500. And then in 1860, when the tribe was moved yet again to what's now Oklahoma, there were 95. So the attrition was profound. And the years following were marked by homelessness, hunger, disease, violence. So in these poems, the main character, Lazarus, is a grown man with children of his own, and he's coping with this sort of catastrophe of movement. Instruments of the true measure. The moving lines of settlement are baptized in the bile of their own digestion. Chickasaw in the northern part of the state, Choctaw in the central. Doomsday book scrolls meld into the linen press of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Reliance on the crude materials of measure bows to precision. Watery ink like corn mash bourbon haloing the mouth. Dress the shale in a trickster's uniform. Stretch marked by the moving zeniths, the first, second, third, fourth principal meridians. Thence west on a blank line to the Indian meridian. The duck's egg. New land again. New land again. Noted in the creamy warp of a government ledger book. They ride south, chased by the paper swish of treaty. A woman swirls a pinch of meal into still water and cooks a limpid gruel around the silver mounds of firestones in the pot. The baby chases for a locust with dry-eyed intent, then sits on a tipped saddle, whining and wringing a worn stirrup leather against her gums. Lazarus takes his oldest boy to scout for food. He watches the boy spur his bare heels against the pony's slight flanks, disappearing into a buffalo wallow so deep he sees just the wispy tips of the sorrel fetlock and the boy's fine dark hair swaying in the movement. With the boy out of sight for the moment, Lazarus lists on the saddle blanket, a hollow throb under his ribs as he leans deep into a cramp, with one hand clamped on the horse's withers. He remembers a hunting camp of his own childhood, his uncle's grin as he sauntered on his knees before the door flap, having sunk a curious elk clean through the lungs, with his blanket still sleep-wrapped across his chest. This giant's land is sparse and miserly. At noon, he gazes deeply into it, as if he could see his children's faces under the frosted crust of the horizon. In the absence of game, they find the haunches of a horse's skeleton, a wayward immigrant's abandoned dining table with curved oak legs and a family crest of stags bleaches in the prairie sun. The boy leads his pony with the leather loose in one hand. He pauses to prod an embossed griffin rearing across the loose slats of a broken headboard. Crouching at a burrow beside a near-dry stream in the soft opal light of near dark, Lazarus calls the boy back to him, his voice the father's confluence of irritation and sorrow. When the child jogs carefully back, his mouth is twisted to hide a smile, arms tight around a clutch of the last of the season's duck eggs. He rides the cash back to the camp, cradled in his lap in a basket of rank weed. Around the fire, they dust ash from the cooked eggs. The baby gags on one, too far along with the feathers and spine of the developing bird. Lazarus holds her mouth shut around it as she struggles until he feels the soft click of her new teeth around the gestational bones and the lump of meat shudders down her throat. And this is the last poem that I'll read. This poem is called Blazed Trunk. Devoid of new frontiers since the Romans mortared Hadrian's Wall, settlers' ancestors saw the axe's blazed union in the milk wood of the living tree as a horse's lean face. Nautilus spiral of township squares. Newly ratified treaties diminished the land with mathematical exactitude. Each acre to be paid out in trust, as the rigs curve smaller and smaller, the establishment of an office of surveyor general, possession following measurement, generally preceding statehood. Numerated agony made linear, as with the bondage line of 36 degrees by 30. Thank you.
Sound Pages is a Jack Straw production. The 2015 curator of this program is Kevin Kraft. This episode of Sound Pages was produced by Daniel Gunther and Levi Fuller. Recording engineers are C.J. Lazenby, Tom Stiles, Mo Preventure, Daniel Gunther, and Steve Dottori. Narrator is Alyssa Keene. And executive director of Jack Straw Cultural Center is Joan Rabinowitz. Theme music by St. Helens String Quartet, produced through the Jack Straw Artist Support Program. The Jack Straw Writers Program is made possible with support from the City of Seattle Office of Arts and Culture, For Culture King County Lodging Tax Fund, the Washington State Arts Commission, the National Endowment for the Arts, Arts Fund, and individual contributors. All of the writers heard in this series are published in the Jack Straw Writers Anthology, available for purchase and featured online at jackstraw.org. Thank you for listening.